Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a space for those who are healing from complex and developmental trauma. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach, survivor, and thriver. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information with insight that can validate, encourage, and support you on your healing journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors and trauma experts, featuring therapists, coaches, and practitioners. We will open up the conversation on effective trauma healing modalities, practices, and tools. If you are interested in trauma recovery coaching, as well as recommended books and healing resources, head over to www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com. And now, here is your host, Monique Coven.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back. On today's episode, I am talking with Dr. Elizabeth A. Stanley. And Elizabeth wrote an acclaimed book called Widen the Window. And this was a book that I read a while ago, and I really loved it. And I had it in my mind that I really wanted her to come on the podcast and share some of the themes in the book. And so she's with us today, and I know that you're going to find this episode so helpful. So a little bit about Elizabeth. So Elizabeth is a political scientist who specializes in international security. But today we're going to learn all about her work and about how her book has helped people cope with stress, extreme stress, and how to become more resilient after stress and trauma. I hope you enjoy this episode with Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Monique. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. I read your book, I think it's maybe a year and a half ago, and I loved it. And I'm so happy that you're here, that we can talk a little bit about the book. It's full of ways to become more resilient. And I love that. And the title, Widen the Window, we hear that all the time in the trauma recovery world. So I'd love to dig in more, you know, more into that. What does that mean? So maybe we could just start with, like, I always like people to help them to get to know you a little bit more, is how did you get into your work with stress and trauma and resilience?
Well, I think we write about, for those of us who do write, what we need to learn ourselves, Monique. In my own case, I come from a lot of chronic stress and trauma in my life. I experienced a lot of childhood adversity and sexual violence as a child and teenager. And then I served in the military. I was an intelligence officer abroad in Korea and Germany, and I did two deployments as a peacekeeper in the Balkans. So a lot of stressful military training. And while I was in Bosnia, I had a near-death experience and needed to be resuscitated. So there was a whole lot of stuff that had happened to this mind and body. And for decades, I coped the way most of us in our culture are socialized to cope, which is to say, I just shoved it under. I compartmentalized it and suppressed it and powered through. And that worked for a while. And it's rewarded. That particular way of coping is rewarded in our culture. But my body was bearing the burden of all of that denial. And by the time I left active duty, after my resuscitation, I was in graduate school, and it all kind of came to the fore. I had a lot of respiratory problems and migraines and insomnia and got depressed. I had depression and PTSD, and turns out I also had Lyme disease, but we didn't know it, and it caused me to lose my eyesight. And that was what finally got my attention. Not being able to see made me wake up and realize I needed to see. And what I needed to see was I needed to do it differently. So I started my own healing journey with mindfulness training, eventually did some clinical training in body-based trauma therapies, I did long silent periods of practice here in the United States and in Burma. And from all of those experiences, I created a resilience training program called Mindfulness-Based Mind Fitness Training. I partnered with some neuroscientists and stress researchers to research its effectiveness. We did several large studies with troops that were preparing to deploy to combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we published the results in science journals. And all of that eventually led to me writing Widen the Window. And, you know, from all of that, I guess the most important piece is there's nothing that is in that book or that I teach that I didn't first learn about in my own mind and body. This was my own laboratory to understand how stress and trauma, the way we function, and then how we can rewire that and heal that to become more resilient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when someone writes a book and it's, you know, from personal experience, we really listen, you know, because we know that you understand, like really get it. So what is the widen, like from the title of your book, Widen the Window? What are the benefits of widening? And what do you mean by widening the window?
So the window, I'm not the only person to use this concept, as you said in your introduction, Monique. The window of tolerance is very common in the therapeutic community in terms of understanding how minds and bodies can function well during stress. So the window of tolerance is the window of tolerance within which we can tolerate stress arousal while also keeping our thinking brain functions and our kind of more unconscious survival brain, automatic survival brain functions. Both of them can stay online and help us to respond effectively during stressful or challenging experiences so that we can make choices, we can make decisions, we can connect with and give and receive support from others during those experiences. And then afterwards, we can recover back to our neurobiological baseline. So someone's, the width of their window affects how much they can function well at differing degrees of arousal. So someone whose window is very narrow, they might experience just a little stress and they get paralyzed or they start acting out or they have to withdraw. They can't be in contact with people. Someone whose window is very wide, in contrast, they can tolerate a very big shock to their system and yet still be able to act with agency, still be able to give and receive social support and connect with others during that event, still be able to kind of come back down afterwards. And someone with a wide window is much more tolerant of unexpected events and change and uncertainty because they have a lot of inner capacity to kind of adapt when life doesn't go the way they want it to go.
Yeah, you just described exactly. I mean, I think people who are listening are shaking their head. Yep, that's my life. No, and before, you know, before I understood anything about trauma and responses, I used to wonder why I would respond, like it would feel so huge, you know, almost like you're being chased by a bear when it's something minor and other people around you, they're just not even blinking. You're like, yes. What's going on? Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, what are the benefits of widening the window, would you say?
Well, I think this is to flow well and adapt when plans get interrupted, when life throws curveballs. I think that's hugely important. We are living in a time on this planet when there is so much transition, so much rapid change, so much uncertainty. And honestly, there are so many people around us with narrowed windows because it has been a period of time with chronic stress during the pandemic, with so many things going on, the war in Ukraine, there's just so much happening that having the capacity to flow well and function well through that is really, really important. And because we're wired as social animals, we actually are interacting on an unconscious level with each other all the time. We're affecting each other's resilience. And so someone whose window is wide, it isn't just helping them function well, it's actually helping everyone around them function well too. So I think it's hugely important. This is a core capacity for functioning on the planet today.
Absolutely. And most trauma survivors were raised by people who were not in their window of tolerance. And like you said, we have these mirror neurons, we pick up. And so, you know, being brought up in our developmental years around that, that's what we take it in.
Yes.
And so it makes sense.
One of the biggest reasons why someone's window may be narrow is their care provider's windows were narrowed, because when our parents and our important care providers didn't have that capacity, when they were already either had a very narrow window or were outside their window all the time, our system couldn't learn all of the different functions it needed to learn to have a wide window. You can't wire that off someone who isn't have a wide window. So it is really important, both for us and then for other people around us.
Yes, yes. And I know that part of healing is, you know, being around, like you said, those people who have the wider, you know, you then feed off of that. And it's, it's just so lovely and healing, that experience. So a question I have for you is, many people in our culture think that stress and trauma are different things, but you highlight how they are a continuum. Why does our culture treat stress and trauma so differently? Like, can you kind of define stress and then define trauma and explain why it's important to sort of recognize what's common about them and what's different?
Yes, absolutely. It's a great question, Monique. So stress is really nothing more than some event either around us or inside us, like traffic or bills, difficult people around us or maybe inside us, things like chronic pain or racing anxious thoughts or, you know, having a cold, being sick, stuffy nose. If our survival brain, the older parts of our brain, which are responsible for keeping us around and alive, that part of the brain is always checking out and appraising our experience. And if it finds whatever the event is, the outer event, the inner event, it finds that threatening or challenging, it then turns on stress arousal. And stress arousal is nothing more than all of the different systems coming together to mobilize energy and focus so that we can deal with that challenge, hopefully successfully. And we were wired originally to have that happen. And then after the challenge ended, we would recover back to a baseline. But in our modern society, many people are not doing that recovery part. They're turning the stress on and then they're keeping it turned on, you know, in a chronic way. And that has a lot of wear and tear on our minds and bodies. So stress is not, we often romanticize it in our culture, where people will talk about how few hours of sleep they had last night or how long it's been since they took a vacation or, you know, all the different things that they've got going on. And we kind of make it, you know, someone who's stressed, it somehow stands for them being important and busy and, you know, successful. And so we kind of romanticize it, when actually it's just nothing more than this ability to mobilize energy to cope with the challenge. Trauma is that process, but then at a higher arousal level. And that's why I think of it as a continuum. And what makes our survival brain go to a higher arousal level is that if, while it is appraising that challenge, it also appraises us as being helpless, powerless, or lacking control in the face of whatever that challenge is. And it's that appraisal of helplessness and powerlessness, that appraisal then makes it turn on a lot of stress and really, really high arousal levels that then turn on even different systems that can often cause us to shut down. We move into freeze. We often get paralyzed. And that process in our culture is somehow considered, even though it's the same thing, just at a higher level, we have this cultural narrative that trauma means that we're broken or that we're damaged or that we're, you know, somehow vulnerable. And victims. And that then, I think, leads people who have experienced events where they've been helpless and powerless and lacking control. They then kind of self-censor about that. They don't like to feel that they've been powerless. They don't want to let anyone know that they've been powerless. And I think that leads us collectively to deny trauma or suppress trauma and disown it. Mm. And by the disowning of it, then it makes it kind of stigmatized. And then the downstream effects of it get stigmatized. And I think many people who have experienced trauma then suffer the consequences, the dysregulation that happens as a consequence. They suffer that in silence, and there's a lot of shame and a lot of self-judgment that get heaped on. I know for myself, one of the reasons why I found this work so powerful, not just in healing myself, but why I wanted to share it with others, was when I learned the science of how our minds and bodies work through this, I began to realize all of the symptoms I had, that wasn't personal. That wasn't like me being weak or broken. That was just what happens when a mind and body have had these experiences, and that's what it does to the systems. It made it much less personal, and it helped really quiet all the shame and self-judgment and helped me realize, okay, just like there were certain things that happened that led to this consequence, if I do these different things differently, if I have, you know, access these leverage points and do it differently, I can unwind that and heal it. And that's not personal either, right? It's just these patterns playing out.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I just loved how you explained that. So let's talk about that. Got excited when you started talking about the rewinding or the patterns. There's so much hope in that. So you talk about three pathways to narrowing the window. Can you explain them to the listeners and explain what happens when our window narrows?
Yes. Yeah, so earlier on, Monique, we were talking about how often those of us who've experienced trauma had parents who were outside their window, mm-hmm. parents with narrow windows. That's actually a part of the first pathway. So the first way that we narrow our window is childhood stress, childhood developmental trauma, and adverse childhood experiences. And often that's because our care providers had narrow windows and didn't have the mind and body capacities to help us wire a wide window. We might have also been coping with traumatic events or childhood illness or some kind of abuse, emotional or physical or sexual. And experiencing those things when we're very young, before our brains and nervous systems and bodies have really wired, means that that chronic stress arousal in childhood affects our neurobiological development. It affects our hormone system. It affects the way our brain and nervous system get wired. So that first pathway of narrowing the window can set this like lifelong trajectory towards lifelong narrowed windows. So it's a very powerful pathway. But in our culture, we tend to write off childhood as not important. So most people don't recognize the effects that that might have now for them as adults. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Many of the people I teach, as they learn this, begin to realize, oh, so much of this comes from then, and I've never really paid attention to it. Yeah. So that's the first pathway. The second pathway are shock trauma events we experience in adulthood. And these are the things our culture conventionally thinks of as traumatic, you know, a natural disaster, a mass shooting, a terrorist attack, war, rape, or physical assault, things that are a lot of arousal all at once that overwhelms our window. And then the third pathway, which many people I think write off as well, but it's very detrimental because it's going on so long, is chronic stress and relational trauma in everyday life. Yeah. And this can be mundane things like not getting enough sleep. In the literature, it's really clear. We see the chronic stress effects of sleep deprivation from just getting 6 hours a night for 2 weeks, which many people in our culture think of as more than enough. And yet it has the same wearing effect on our window. Mm. Caring for a sick family member, having workplace tension, discrimination or harassment in our workplace, and some of our habits, contribute to this third pathway, things that we do to feel better, but that aren't helping with recovery. I talk about those as stress reaction cycle habits. And so all three of these pathways mm-hmm. narrow our window if we don't allow for some real recovery.
Okay. In your book and also in your resilience training program, Mindfulness-Based Mind Fitness Training, you focus a lot on agency and choice. So why is agency such a determining factor in whether we experience stress or trauma?
That's a great question, Monique. And as we were talking about a little while ago, stress and trauma are a continuum. Mm-hmm. Where we fall on that continuum is determined by the current width of our window. So as you said earlier on, like you remembered from earlier in your life, a little thing would all of a sudden be like feeling like a bear chasing you. That was a time in your life when your window was really narrow. And for someone else whose window was wider, that might have not even been a blip. For you, that was a whole lot, right? So that moved you into the trauma end of the spectrum. So if our window is narrow, a small amount of arousal is going to be a really big deal. A larger round arousal for someone with a wider window, it's okay. And where we fall on that depends upon whether our survival brain perceives if we're helpless, powerless, and lacking control. Mm-hmm. The best kind of antidote to feeling helpless and powerless is knowing that we have choice, knowing that we have agency. So the less agency we perceive ourselves to have, the more likely it is we're going to experience trauma. And that was a really important principle that I built into MFIT. So that we train our brain and body to be able to access choice in every situation, even really sucky situations. Mm-hmm. But when we can access choice, we're protecting ourselves from experiencing trauma. And even if we can't control what's going on around us, there is one thing we always do have choice about, and that is choosing where we're directing our attention. And that's a big part of what we train in MFIT, is how to be able to direct your attention even during really challenging events. Because when we choose where we're directing our attention, we are accessing agency and we're protecting ourselves from trauma.
So what's just coming to my mind is I'm thinking, when you are in one of those experiences where your sympathetic nervous system is very activated, you're saying there is a place for you to direct your attention. So is that something that you learn, or is that something we have access to when we're in sympathetic, when we're feeling that surge of energy?
When someone has been training their attention actively to attentional controls, to attentional cues that their survival brain knows to be safe and grounding, mm-hmm. and through MFIT, someone is training their attention repeatedly to those attentional cues, your system learns then, even during high arousal, it becomes second nature to redirect your attention back to those cues that then help you access choice. So while someone who hasn't been training themselves consistently, if they're in very high sympathetic arousal, and maybe you even added on dorsal parasympathetic so that you've moved into the freeze zone, they might not be able to direct their attention. But from our published research, we've shown that, and going through mock combat drills, like IED blasts ambushes where they're wearing heart rate and breathing rate monitors, and their heart rate is like 220 beats per minute, they're still redirecting their attention. And that's because they have been training it day after day. They know it gets built into the way that their system can respond. It's a different set of implicit tools mm-hmm. that they can wire for themselves. Mm. Any of us can wire for ourselves. It just takes the repeated practice each day.
Yeah, I love that. So how should someone begin the work of widening their window? Can you give us some concrete strategies they can use? I always like to, when I talk to someone, I always like to ask them if they could maybe share a couple of strategies or one strategy, something that the listeners can take with them.
Absolutely. I want to start by offering two principles, and that will explain why these strategies work. So the only part of our brain that controls whether we're turning stress on or turning it off is our survival brain. And so we have to help our survival brain to perceive safety. When our survival brain functions perceive safety, then it will automatically move in the direction of standing down, turning stress off, moving towards recovery. And we can choose where we're directing our attention. If we direct it to cues that help the survival brain perceive safety, that's going to help. So knowing those principles, then we can start structuring our habits to help the survival brain perceive safety. Because if the survival brain isn't perceiving safety, we are not going to be turning that stress off. The most important, we have two really easy survival brain attentional cues for feeling safety. One of them, and they both relate to interoceptive awareness, it's awareness of sensations with our bodies. One of them is attention, is directing our attention very widely out to listening to sounds and seeing color and sights around you. So orienting to our surroundings, not locking in on anything in particular, but just noticing the flow of sound and silence. And just keep directing your attention outward in that way to the present sounds. And that can often help. The other one, the one that is part of the first exercise in the MFIT sequence, is directing our attention to the sensations of contact between our body and our surroundings. So the first exercise is called the contact points, and it's redirecting the attention over and over again to the contact of the backs of the legs and the butt with the chair, the bottoms of the feet with the floor, your hands touching each other, touching your legs and your lap. And you might notice things like pressure or hardness or dampness or softness. If you're in bare feet, you might notice the texture of the carpet. If you're having a hard time finding the sensations under your butt or your feet, you can even just rub your hands, like the palms of your hands, up and down your thighs and notice the texture of the fabric, you know, on your pants against the palms of your hands. And just keep redirecting your attention to these sensations of contact. That is very calming and grounding for the survival brain. It helps the survival brain recognize I'm stable, I'm safe, I'm grounded, and that allows the recovery to happen. So this is available to us all the time, and practicing just 5 minutes a day. The first audio exercise is 5 minutes. People can get it on my website. If any of your listeners want to download it, they can. And it really does help train our survival brain and interrupt those patterns of the arousal going on and on. It can sort of interrupt it and help down-regulate. So that's one very concrete strategy for your listeners. The other one that I really want to put a plug for, because our survival brain does a ton of recovery, is during sleep. So really, I know it can be hard when we experienced a lot of stress and trauma. I had insomnia for years, but setting the conditions for getting restful sleep, because the survival brain does a lot of recovery during sleep. So aiming for at least 7 hours a night, and between sleep and training our attention, if you just do two things, those two can make a big difference.
Oh, thank you. I love those. Yes, great. So Elizabeth, this was so interesting and so helpful. So before we go, is there anything else you want to add or say?
I just want to thank you for having me on today, Monique. We live in a very stressful time on the planet, and I'm glad that there are resources available for people. And this podcast is a very important one for helping people to understand that what is going on in their minds and bodies, they're not alone, and it is not personal. It is very much their wiring playing out. And having access, as you said at one point in our conversation, and I want to, this will be my last comment, is how much our social wiring, we are resonating with people in our environment. We resonate with the news, we resonate with social media, we resonate with nature. So choosing to resonate with nature, choosing to resonate with well-regulated people, and working with well-regulated people as yourself, it's really important. we share our resilience with the people around us. It's an important thing that we have to offer.
Oh, well, I want to thank you for putting this out into the world. It's helping so many people, because so many people, like you mentioned in the past, often blame themselves, you know, personalize what is wrong with me. And the freedom that comes, the self-compassion that can come with knowing that this is our biology and that it can change, but that it is normal. It's not like a disorder. It's a response. So I thank you so much for putting all your work out. It means so much to everyone.
Thank you so much, Monique. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
If you'd like to find out more about trauma recovery coaching with me, you can visit my website at thehealingtraumapodcast.com. There you'll find a variety of ways that we could work together.